Welcome back to Bond Bros. I'm your host, JT, and I'm joined by my brother.
Jason Johnson.
Last week, we saw the origins of the James Bond film series with Dr. No and From Russia with Love. This week, we're covering the two films that truly kicked Bond Mania into high gear and made it the series that we've all come to know and love. Excuse me. On top of that, we'll also get the origin story for one of the longest legal disputes that the producers of the series ever had to face. Before we get to that, though, we go to the third James Bond film, the movie that most Bond fans claim to have it all. That film is Goldfinger, and it's time to get started. Goldfinger came out in 1964 from director Guy Hamilton, replacing Terrence Young, who couldn't return for this entry. He was already making another movie. The writers of this movie include Paul Dean and regular writer Richard Maybaum. The music is by John Barry, and for the first time, I get to talk about who did the theme. The theme for Goldfinger is, of course, done by Shirley Bassey, probably the theme that sets the bar for everything that came afterwards was
Absolutely.
Goldfinger. The synopsis is simple for this one. James Bond is sent to investigate Auric Goldfinger, a seemingly legitimate gold dealer who may also be smuggling his gold illegally. On the way, Bond learns that Goldfinger has a far more sinister plot involving the gold reserves at Fort Knox. So before we sort of go through this movie, I will ask your thoughts on it, Jason. What'd you think of Goldfinger?
Probably my favorite Bond film. I love this movie so much, just because it sets. Whereas the Dr. No introduces us to the character. From Russia with Love gives us a few of the little tropes. Goldfinger sets the fucking tone. You know, this is what this is as wild as it can get, man. You know, which
And
we find out later is not as wild as it can get. I
and what
had you
was
Moonraker. Anyway,
when did you first watch Goldfinger? Because I
I
know some of them you didn't watch till more recent,
actually
so.
didn't watch Goldfinger through until about a year ago. I had seen bits and pieces and stuff, you know, because you know you're flipping through channels when I was younger and it would be on or whatever. And I knew that this movie. I knew, of course, of the famous scene, which we'll talk about later. I didn't really, I never really watched it all the way through. And then finally, last year, I went through kind of a Bond phase and started watching these movies. And yeah, finally watched it all the way through, and it quickly became my favorite of all of these.
Yeah, for me, what happened with this one is back in early, it had to have been early 96, Dad wanted to rent a movie that I had never heard of and didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about Bond at this point. He wanted to rent a movie called GoldenEye. And so we watched the movie, and I guess Dad wanted to see how I reacted to the movie first. And of course, I ended up loving GoldenEye. And so Dad was like, hey, you know, there's like 12, 13 more of these, not knowing there was like 16 more of them. And I said, no, I didn't. And then he explained to me, like, now this is the first with Pierce Brosnan, so the others have different actors. I said, okay, let's do it. He said, I want to start you out with a certain film. I want to, yeah, basically, Dad was like, I want to start you out on one of the Sean Connery films. And I was already a fan of Connery's in the 90s from like movies like The Hunt for Red October, you know, like I was already like old Connery. So a chance to see, well, what was young Connery like, you know? And Dad introduced me to Goldfinger. He wanted to see how I'd react to the older films next. And I love the movie. I mean, for years and years and years and years, I would tell people, oh, Goldfinger's the best. Goldfinger's the number one movie. Now, that may or may not still be the case. We'll find out as we go along in the series. But I absolutely love this movie. And we'll just break it down a bit here. First off, it's the cold open to this movie is the first time we got like a fun adventure. We got that was not related to the movie. That was done intentionally. Guy Hamilton said that he wanted audiences to just have this sort of silly adventure. So by the time the opening credits were done, you were in it. You were ready to roll.
Yeah.
And then we die, and it's a great moment. I love it because he comes in this wetsuit with a very fake looking dead dove on his head,
yeah,
or dead pigeon or whatever the hell that was supposed to be. But we get another iconic moment, which kind of adds to the inventiveness of this. He takes off the wetsuit, and underneath the wetsuit, a perfectly fine white tuxedo. That's after he sets the bombs to blow up a heroin factory, is what he's trying to blow up.
Right.
Then he goes, meets with his contact, who says he should just get on a plane and get out of there. He said, yeah, but we've got to finish up something first. Goes to his room. What does he got to finish? Well, there's a beautiful woman, man.
Of course.
And then, so he goes to her and looks like they're about to, things are about to get interesting. But when he pulls back after kissing her, what should he notice in the reflection of her eye? Mm-hmm. But a man sneaking up on him from behind.
Of course.
And, he immediately throws the woman in front of it and he hits her instead.
Yeah.
And then he throws the guy into the bathtub. Guy's about to get his gun, so he slams a heater into the bathtub. That stuntman actually got burned in that scene because there was an effect to where when the lamp hit, the cord accidentally wrapped around his leg. And so when the stuntman will tell you that when he's grimacing in pain, it's real because that wire got caught and it was starting to burn his leg.
I'll be.
But he didn't. But he committed because he was like, no, not until he says cut. And that's a couple of times you'll hear that.
Right.
But that's a fun little adventure. And of course, he has his quip, you know, when he's like, shocking.
Yes.
Positively shocking.
Yes.
Then we get into the opening credits with the Shirley Bassey song, one of the best James Bond themes out there. Absolutely brilliant. The opening credits this time, though, were actually designed by Robert Brownjohn. This would be the last time a film would not have opening titles done by Maurice Binder until GoldenEye in 95.
Mm-hmm.
After the opening credits, we move to Miami where James Bond thinks he's on leave, but really his old friend Felix Leiter pays him a visit.
Yep.
And says that M sent Bond to Miami to watch after Goldfinger for reasons he won't know until later on in the movie. Sek Linder, I think I'm saying his name right, plays Felix in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably my least favorite actor to play Felix Leiter.
Yeah.
Because he looks older than Bond, doesn't look like he belongs in the field alongside Bond.
Right.
And looks like he should be an aging detective more than he's like a spy. He's like a detective on his last big case or some yeah. shit. But we are introduced to Gert Frobe as Goldfinger,
yeah.
who, let's face facts, iconic Bond villain.
Yes.
maybe second only to one other villain, which we'll get to in a later film. But he's there, he's cheating and at a game, and then Bond realizes that there's a woman, Jill Masterson, who's looking down at his card or at the opponent's cards and telling him what, you know,
yeah.
to do next. And then of course Bond does that thing where he antagonizes the fucking villain. He just flat out mm-hmm. says, "Hey, this is Bond."
Yeah.
And you're gonna lose, let's say, 5. No, let's be generous. Let's make it 10, you know?
And, yeah.
And then, of course, he gets the girl and Goldfinger loses his money. But, of course, this always ends with something bad happening to Bond. You'll find later in the series, does Bond ever learn his lesson antagonizing the villain?
Right. So,
because later on, we learn that Bond is not a Beatles fan.
Yeah.
Because there's a scene where he's like, certain things just not done, like drinking Dom Perignon at a degree less than whatever and listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
Yeah.
Which is ironic as hell, considering one of the best themes will come from a Beatle later on.
Mm-hmm.
But he's knocked out. We don't know who by who, but there's a silhouette of a man in a top hat. When Bond comes to, he finds Jill Masterson. Has been killed by being covered in gold paint. Now, that comes from an old urban legend that if yep. you paint all of your skin you die from skin asphyxiation. Yeah. And they actually believed that more in the 60s when this movie was made. And, right. and it wasn't like they were like superstitious. Like they actually thought this was a thing. But if you don't think that I'm being real, Mythbusters disproved it. Like yeah. it was even a thing on Mythbusters.
Yeah, people have thought for years that she died during the filming of this film because it clogged all her pores and she died of skin asphyxiation. And it's just not true, folks. She lived for many, many years after this movie.
Yeah. And it was also inspired by a real life like fear for like cabaret mm-hmm. dancers, right. which is mentioned in the movie. Speaking of which, that's mentioned in the M briefing. We get another famous M briefing. You'll get a lot of these through the series.
Yep.
Bond feels responsible for Jill's death, but he reminds and M kind of chastises him for like you got this woman killed, and you shouldn't make this personal. And Bond very smartly goes, "You told me to look after this fucker, but you didn't tell me why. I didn't know I was antagonizing someone who was, yeah. was lethal. Yeah. You just told me to babysit this fucker."
Right.
And so M and Bond then meet a gold expert. This is probably the most boring part because it starts with the gold expert. "Well, you must see by the treaty of blah, 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 blah." And he just yeah. rattles off all this information. But the point of it is the real reason they want Bond to meet up with or to investigate Goldfinger is, yes, he seems to be a legitimate industrialist specializing in gold, but they don't know how he transfers his gold from country to country. And if they can discover that it's somehow done illegally, then they can arrest him and seek the bulk of the gold he holds. So really, they just want his fucking gold.
Right.
And if they can find a loophole to get it, they're going to try to find a loophole to get yeah. it. And so they come up with a plan for Bond to meet with Goldfinger socially and present himself as someone who may be in possession of stolen Nazi gold. They give him like a Nazi gold bar and like, "Yeah, entice him with this, but don't lose it."
Yeah.
But before he goes to see Goldfinger, he gets to go see Q. And probably one of the greatest Q briefings that we'll get in the series. Because he introduces him to his most famous gadget, the Aston Martin DB5. And I'm sorry, that is a beautiful looking car.
Yes, it is.
The car's gadgets behind the scenes were implemented mostly by John Steers, based on gadget designs by production designer Ken Adam. The car was a huge sensation at the time of the movie's release and toured all over the world in promotion for Goldfinger's release
mm-hmm.
Into theaters. The car, of course, was featured in several commercials and several toys were made from RC cars, diecast models. Here's the real quick kicker, though. One of the original cars actually used in the film was sold at an auction. However, it was somehow stolen at the airport. And as far as I can find, it has never turned up even to this day.
Oh, wow.
It disappeared off the face of the fucking earth. I also love that this begins Q's contempt for Bond. That starts in this movie because Desmond Llewellyn, the guy who plays Q, he said that, you know, when he came in, he started to play the scenes. It's like, "Oh, hello, 007. Here's your car." You know, he started, you know, mm-hmm. just kind of running it down. And Hamilton said, "Cut." "You, Desmond, no, 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 no. You hate this guy. He never treats your property right. He never brings it back in one piece. You have utter contempt for this guy." And so that's why in the scene, he's like, "I never joke about my work, 007.
Yeah.
And we get that now famous friendly yet adversarial relationship between Bond and Q.
Yeah.
And beyond getting the DB5, Q also supplies Bond with a couple of tracking devices, a big magnetic one he can plant on something, and a small one that fits in the heel of his shoe, which will be parodied time and time again. what'd you think of the Q briefing, Jason? You know, Desmond Llewellyn, this is kind of the scene that everyone says is the Q scene.
Like yeah, that, I mean,
every Q scene afterwards well, is based off this.
Yeah, it sets the tone. Again, these are the early films. And then, yeah, pretty much every Q scene after this is this scene. And please, 007, don't go and destroy. You know, it's all, you know, he, like you say, friendly but adversarial. Please stop fucking up all my stuff. 007, you know.
So, after this scene, though, from time to time, I will point out, I won't point out all of them because there's too many to point out, but Bond films are also noted for having plot holes, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, the big plot hole I have is they want to send Bond in undercover as a, like, someone else who specializes in gold and play golf with Goldfinger and be like, hey, I got more where this came from with the gold bar he got. He just antagonized this guy in Miami. How did they ever think that Goldfinger right. was going to buy this?
Mm-hmm. Like, didn't know he who he was. Yeah,
I mean, to this credit of this film, at the end of this scene, Goldfinger is like, twice our paths have met. So, like, you know, Goldfinger right. acknowledges. But there'll be films later on where that's not so obvious to the villain.
Right.
This is where Sean Connery's love of golf began. He golfed on this film and he fell in love with the sport of just going out playing golf and yeah. became a huge golf aficionado. But of course, this is also where we get to meet Oddjob, played yes. by, he's played by Harold Sakata, and Hamilton saw him in a wrestling match. And that's how he
yeah.
became really one of the most iconic henchmen of all the Bond heavies. Also the one you hate playing against in GoldenEye 007 on N64. Fuck that bastard. With his bowler hat, which for those who don't know, he has a blade in the bowler hat. And to which Goldfinger's like, Oddjob. And he throws it at a statue and it knocks the statue's head off.
Yeah. I love Oddjob so much because he gave us one of the best lines in any movie. A shoe. I mean, really, a shoe. Who throws a shoe? Yeah. Random yes, task.
random task. But with that hat, though, it establishes another thing about how And you could kind of say Robert Shaw, Red Grant's watch that had the Garrett wire in it,
mm-hmm.
that the henchman is always going to have some sort of gimmick
right.
With his weapon that's going to help him out. Gert Frobe, as I mentioned, plays Goldfinger. He was a German actor who had to be dubbed due to they found out when he got on set he can't speak a goddamn word of English.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who are dubbed in these, especially these early movies. Ursula right. Andress was dubbed. I don't mention it because there are so many of them. I don't mention it usually. But there was some controversy in Frobe's career when it was revealed mm-hmm. that he was a Nazi soldier in World War II.
Right.
However, before the controversy could really blow up, a Jewish family quickly came to his defense when they revealed that Frobe put his own life at risk to get them out of the country.
Yeah.
To avoid the camps. And so it's one of those things. Of course, he was in the Nazi army as a German during World War II, but
right.
doesn't mean he was a goddamn SS agent, you know?
Right. Yeah. He wasn't the worst of the worst. He was just a member of his country's military, which when you consider almost everyone was conscripted into that military. Yeah, if you were German yeah. during World War II, you were probably in the army.
And of course, Oddjob, real quick, going back to him just a second, he'll always be remembered for his most iconic line. Ah!
Yeah, right. Yes.
Speaking of which, the reason I bring that up, that's what he
which
does.
Which they dubbed because he couldn't say, ah! Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the golf game. Because mm-hmm. at one point Goldfinger tries to cheat and Bond catches him in the act and switches a ball. And I love his caddy. His caddy is so happy that he's caught who we later find out is the owner of the club. So that's probably why the caddy's happy.
Right.
His boss is getting caught cheating at golf for once.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's like, you switched the ball, sir. He's like, yeah, then we've got him. I'm like, well, let's see if he doesn't notice the switch first.
Yeah.
Of course, he switched his Schlesinger 1 ball with a Schlesinger 7. So let's yeah. just keep that in mind. I enjoy that scene. I always enjoy a good scene where Bond kind of... He usually, in later films, he'll usually do it at the casino. He'll one-up them at a casino playing a game of Baccarat or some shit like
right.
that. But here, it's just another one of those scenes I absolutely love. After that, though, he plants a tracking device on the car. And so Bond starts to track him. And while doing that, at one point, after Goldfinger has stopped to get something, he's apparently shot at by another woman, by a mysterious woman, a blonde, mysterious blonde woman. And I love how he uses the DB5's gadgets. He uses the tire shredders, which shreds the whole half of the car, not just the tires, but it, yet they act like, oh, a double blowout. And also a huge fucking gash in the car.
Right.
But runs her off the road, where he soon learns that she's Tilly Masterson. She's the sister of Jill, who's killed at the beginning of the movie. I'll put it this way. In the book Goldfinger, she's a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And just like in this movie, she dies because apparently Fleming has issues with lesbians.
Really? I didn't know that one.
Yeah. Either one of two things happens to lesbians in Ian Fleming's novels. They die, or Bond switches them, converts them.
Oh, Jesus.
If you know what I mean. Yeah. So anyone who wants to complain about any outdated views of the movies, just read the books. Good God.
Yeah, definitely have outdated views in those.
But what she reveals is that she's actually one of the worst shots in the world. She wasn't trying to kill Bond. Obviously, she was targeting Goldfinger for the death of her sister. Unfortunately, both her and Bond get into a car chase with Goldfinger's men. And then she becomes the casualty. You know, someone's got to die with Oddjob's hat.
Right.
And she becomes the casualty of Oddjob. And they capture Bond. And stupidly, they let him drive his own fucking car.
Yeah.
With a henchman with a gun next to him. Just saying, yeah, just drive. And so the car chase. So then he ejects the guy, because there's an ejector seat in this car, by the way. I should have established that in the cue briefing. That's like, it blows off this portion of the roof and fires the ejector seat, to which Bond is like, you must be joking. Yeah. But after that, there's another bit of a car chase, but apparently they anticipate high-speed car chases, and he starts shooting at headlights that are just reflected in a mirror, and he crashes. And he's unconscious, which leads to one of my favorite scenes in the movie. He wakes up in a room, he's strapped to a table, and there's a big laser in there. It's this giant laser beam that, according to Goldfinger, he uses to cut his gold and stuff like that.
Right.
And so he puts it in between Bond's nether regions and turns it on, and it starts to slowly inch its way up. In a perfectly escapable situation. and it's slowly creeping up to, his region. And it leads to my best exchange, the first part of which is the name of this episode, when which Bond asks Goldfinger, do you expect me to talk? And Goldfinger gives the ultimate line, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Yes. Just a... the best line in any Bond film, in my opinion. I love it.
And this is also the start of another trend that we'll see in the other Bond movies. Mm-hmm. Bond uses the minimal amount of information that he has on the villain to make him not kill him. In which he says, if I don't report, 008 will replace me. He's like, well, hopefully he's better than you. But then he says, but I've told them everything, including Operation Grand Slam, which is the only words he's heard Goldfinger use up to this point.
Yeah.
Bond is bluffing that he knows everything, and Goldfinger says, well, we can't take a chance. Maybe he's better to us alive, and thus he's knocked out with a tranquilizer.
Right.
The laser scene, Jason. I mean, come on.
Oh, that's the best line in any Bond film ever. No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. You know, that's just... perfect.
If people don't understand, we've been quoting Austin Powers a couple of times here.
Yeah.
And even that, I just rewatched Austin Powers the other day, and there's a point where Dr. Evil goes, no, Mr. Powers, I expect you to die.
Yeah.
He recreates the scene, but it's just iconic. But like, God damn it, we go into one iconic scene after another with this
movie. Oh, yeah.
Because after he gets knocked out, He wakes up on a plane, and there's Honor Blackman as probably, in my opinion, the number one Bond girl. With the number one sexual innuendo name ever, Pussy Galore. She's Goldfinger's personal pilot, and as an example of someone who is in the book a lesbian that turns good due to Bond's charms,
I'll be damned.
there you go. Blackman was chosen to play Pussy because she is already doing work on the Avengers. She wrapped up her, I think she did two series of the Avengers, and she was asked to be a part of this this movie. And I love it. My name is Pussy Galore. I must be dreaming. But she's a no-nonsense Bond girl as well. Like, she's very much her own woman. She's not just kind of a ditzy girl that Bond must save or, you know, anything of that nature. She actually is a character that's pretty tough in her own right. And she actually plays a pretty big role in saving the day at the end of the film. In fact, some people have said that like Bond doesn't really do anything to stop the plot of this movie, but we'll get to more of that later. The only other scene I love in the plane is he goes to change and the flight attendant is looking through these peepholes and he can see them, and so he puts like shaving cream on the mirror, he hangs his suit up over the other one and to trip her out. That's just another cool thing where it shows the thing about the early Bond films is Bond always shows that like he's a step ahead, even when it seems like he's a step behind. But eventually we end up in the exotic location of Kentucky. And you can tell that because at one point when Felix goes to check on Bond, he exits a Kentucky Fried fucking chicken, because that's how you establish you're in Kentucky. Bond is held prisoner, where he briefly escapes his cell and catches one of the coolest meetings ever. Goldfinger has acquired all the mob bosses into one room to have a meeting with them. This very elaborate fucking meeting for a bunch of people he's about to fucking kill. He's like, he goes to this thing, he's like, I'm gonna rob Fort Knox. Who is he doing this meeting for? Just get him into a room and kill them.
There's
Because his
no
real.
need for all of this. You are about to murder all these people, and you choose to, I guess, make it easier for them because you lulled them into a sense of security. I don't know what the fuck he's doing.
I think it's a thematic. Well, I think, I mean, obviously, it's a thematic plot beat so that we will believe in his, what we think is his original goal with Fort Knox, which is to rob it. I listened to this other podcast that covered this movie, and they said, I want the story of the that's about the guy who has to make all these tables and maps and displays for Bond villains. They were like, oh, you need it to rise up out of the table. That's going to take 6 more weeks.
And it's for a scene that really is completely unnecessary.
But Bond is recaptured, and when he meets back up with Goldfinger, though, like I said, Felix goes to check in on him. Goldfinger sees that they're checking in on him, so he brings Bond out to show that, like, oh, Bond's fine. Bond's got everything under control. And so Bond meets with Goldfinger, and he says, how are you going to rob fucking Fort Knox? And he's like, who says anything about robbing it? And then it's like, ah, the real plot thickens. And Bond realizes that with this character he met earlier that we saw very, very briefly, it was like a general or some sort, that he has secured a nuclear bomb. And what he plans to do is radiate the gold at Fort Knox, which will be radiated for, I think he says something like 59 and a half years to be exact, or some shit like that. And the idea is that it will make Goldfinger's own gold supply the most valuable in the world. Now, here we have another thing where it's like, dude, you have a gold supply.
Yeah.
You are rich enough.
Enough is enough, yeah. Dude. Yeah, there's no need.
You don't have to go this far.
I will say this much. The plan does, well, first of all, that place is going to be irradiated far longer than that. You'll never get back.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be ready far longer than that. Second of all, you would melt most of the gold, burn some of it up, you know, which to his plan, when it comes to things like gold, scarcity drives cost. So, you know, it is true that it's, you know, it would work. It'd make his gold worth so much more. But really, how much do you need, dude? One gold bar you could go buy a fucking house with, dude.
Yeah. But after he reveals the plan to Bond, he allows Pussy to take him on a tour, and they go to a barn where they have a nice little roll in the hay. They perform some judo rolls on each other, and he woos her, so to speak. And so now she's on his side. What's funny is Blackman commented about this scene. She said, on the Avengers, I had to do judo on hard concrete floors. I mean, I did most of my stunts. This roll in the hay was literally a roll in the hay for me.
Yeah.
Like, it was easy
it was
for
nothing.
Her. And she had a lot of fun filming that scene. And then finally, we do end up eventually in Fort Knox. They head that way. The idea is that Pussy Galore and her flying circus, because she has a team of pilots, will release the gas, and it will kill any of the guards and everybody that's around. She doesn't know that. She's still under the original plan, but Bond told her what the actual plan was, so she was able to switch out the canisters, we later find out. But it apparently knocks everyone out. And they bring the big laser in that was almost about to kill Bond, and they blow open the door to Fort Knox. Ken Adam was actually able to observe Fort Knox at that time closer than anyone else had exterior-wise.
Yes.
He got to fly over it. He got to fly over it pretty low. He got to see the exterior up close on the ground, closer than a lot of people did. Right. This was due to the fact that, man, Cubby knew a lot of people. Albert R. Cubby Broccoli, the producers of these movies, he knew a colonel who said, yeah, sure, we love these Bond movies. Go ahead, fly over, do whatever.
Right.
But however, for obvious reasons, they could not go inside the vault.
Yeah, can't go inside, couldn't film, couldn't do anything,
right. So Ken Adam had to design this big, huge set that you see that has stacks of gold along the walls and all this stuff. And he actually got a call after the release of the movie from a real official from Fort Knox just saying, well, you definitely have a big imagination, don't you?
Yeah. So, it is nothing like what's in this movie.
No. Because eventually they did show
there is a documentary.
Interior.
Yeah, there is a documentary out there that you can watch, and it's about Fort Knox, and it shows, of course, like, they don't do a complete walkthrough of the building because they're not going to show you all the security measures and everything. But, yeah, they do show the inside of one of the vaults and all that jazz. And, yeah, it's neat. I mean, but boy, howdy, that place is locked up tighter than, well, Fort Knox.
Of course, it's soon revealed the army was not knocked out by the gas, thanks to Pussy Galore. So there's a big fight that breaks out outside the vault, but then Bond and Oddjob have their final fight inside, which involves a lot of Connery chest bumping Harold Sakata as Oddjob, trying to hit him with various sticks and levers and whatever the hell else he can find. And then, like, at one point he gets Oddjob's hat, he throws it, but he misses Oddjob. It hits a cell, or the bars in front of one of the stacks of gold. And then Oddjob goes to get his hat. That's when Bond electrocutes Goldfinger through his hat and kills him, thus once again using the henchman's own gimmick against him.
Right.
In that scene, though, this is the second era where, or this is the second scene where someone actually got hurt. Sakata grabbed the hat, and as all those sparks and stuff are flying around him, his hand is actually getting burned by the hat because it did heat up during the pyrotechnics.
Yeah.
And finally, Hamilton shouted, cut, and when he saw that he actually got burns on his hand, he asked, why did you hold on? And the actor said simply, you hadn't yelled cut yet. So,
yeah.
It goes to show how powerful a director can be on the set of a movie. And also, finally, during this big climactic scene, the bomb is about to go off. You may notice, Jason, that when you saw the timer counting down, it wasn't counting off in seconds. It was going really fast.
Right.
The reason being was it was supposed to stop at 3 seconds left. But Saltzman, the other producer of these films, Harry Saltzman, saw that the counter was a 3-digit display, mm-hmm. and he told editor Peter Hunt, it's got to stop on 007. That's too golden yeah. a moment. And so Peter Hunt complied, but he also adjusted the countdown to where that was technically 3 seconds left on the clock somehow. That was yeah. just his little yeah. subliminal, like, oh, if they hadn't turned this off. This is where people sometimes complain that Bond doesn't actually stop anything because it's pussy galore that switches out the tanks, the army that comes in and saves the day, mm-hmm. and apparently some sort of nuclear physicist or something quickly reaches in and shuts the bomb off before Bond can even make a move on the bomb.
Right.
Sean Connery himself even had complaints about that. He said, Bond doesn't solve his own case in this movie.
Right.
Like, that was his big problem with Goldfinger as he was making it. And I think he got his way in that, like, I think in the original script, he didn't help relay the information to other characters as much. And so they changed it to where it was like, oh, okay, he told her and that, so he would have some sort of involvement in how this all ended.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the final scene is back on a private plane. Bond thinks he's going to Washington to meet the president, but oh no, the flight crew has been found bound and gagged. And it turns out Pussy Galore is piloting the plane because Goldfinger thinks that, or, you know, she's still trying to act like she's with Goldfinger. And then Goldfinger is on the plane and he has a gold revolver, and soon Bond and him get into a scuffle. They shoot out the window and Goldfinger is sucked out the window.
Yep.
Goodbye, Goldfinger. But of course, it's depressurized the plane. And so he goes to try to help Pussy Galore crash land. Obviously, or not crash land, but to get control of the plane, they can't. It looks like on the radar, the plane crashes. But then we see that they did parachute out of the plane, and boom, they're together. World is saved. Another Bond adventure has come to a close.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the premiere of this movie for just a moment. Goldfinger premiered in 1964, and this is when Bond mania truly kicked into high gear. But sadly, the one person who would never see that happen was Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming visited the set of Goldfinger, but before the film premiered, he died of a heart attack in 1964. Yeah. This caused such a sensation that, like, several other movies and TV shows started to pop up. You started to see the spy genre as we know it today blossom from this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was the first film everyone claimed to have at all. And it's the one where the producers sometimes want to recreate alongside From Russia with Love. Generally, the producers, when they go into making a Bond movie, which they do not succeed at it all the time, they want the tone of From Russia with Love, which was much more a straight spy thriller, but they want the excitement of Goldfinger. So it's got to have big action set pieces. It's got to have gadgets from this point forward. You know, it's got to have all those elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
Still one of my favorite films in the Bond series. I absolutely love it. It became a huge, huge sensation. We're off to the races with Goldfinger.
Yeah.
And with that, Jason, I'm ready. I'm going to be ranking the films at the end of adding it to my ranking at the end of the episode, both the films that we do. But at the end of each film, you get to give it a rating, like we would normally do on Horror Bros. What is your rating for Goldfinger?
10 out of 10 lasers, apparently meant to cut you from the nuts up.
10 out of 10 nut-cutting lasers.
Yes.
Before we get into the next film, I kind of have to establish a background for this movie. The fourth James Bond adventure had quite the road to get to the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with Thunderball, which is the next film we're covering, is a man named McClory, Kevin McClory.
Yes.
In the late 50s, Ian Fleming wanted to write his own screenplay for a James Bond movie. He was having trouble with the screenplay and met a young producer named Kevin McClory through Fleming's friend and producer, Ivar Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Jack Winningham, Fleming and McClory tried to write an underwater adventure where Bond would try to stop an original creation at that time named Spectre, because Fleming didn't want to use Smersh in his movies, in this particular screenplay, because he felt he had overused Smersh in his novels. That's the Russian counterintelligence organization in the books. And so it involved Spectre ransoming the world with two nuclear warheads. There was a character created named Blofeld. All of this plays into not just this movie, but later movies in the series, which right. we'll get to when we get to them. The project obviously fell through. McClory couldn't get the funding for the movie is what ultimately caused it. And Fleming, who was just at this point frustrated with the whole process, decided to write a new book, but he used some of the ideas in the screenplay, such as Spectre and Blofeld and the idea about two hijacked warheads. And he called the new book Thunderball. McClory got an advanced release of the book, and he immediately called for the book not to get published. He sued Fleming, and while the attempt to get the mass publication of the book halted, that failed, he still sued Fleming. And after a long legal battle, Fleming just decided, fuck it, I'll settle. You know, I mean, he was just, let me just go ahead and settle. The settlement gave McClory the rights to make a Thunderball film, the rights to Spectre and Blofeld, and the right to make a film without Eon Productions, meaning he could make a rival Bond film if he so desired. So, and Fleming also had to add to the book based on a screenplay by Fleming, McClory, and Whittingham. Cubby and Saltzman saw that after that ruling, McClory could make his own Bond film without them. So they came up with a deal for him. They said, let's produce Thunderball in the official series that we've got going. We will name you, Kevin McClory, the sole producer. That's why there's a big produced by Kevin McClory credit in the movie, in the opening credits. But in return, McClory could not make another Thunderball adaptation for the next 10 years. We'll get to more on that later.
Absolutely.
Because McClory did agree to the deal, and production was underway for the fourth James Bond adventure. That's the end of the first part of McClory. McClory is going to be a real-life Bond villain that will pop up in this series from time to time. But for now, we got the official adaptation of Thunderball, released in 1965, with a returning Terrence Young coming back to direct the movie. Writer John Hopkins was joined by Maybaum once again, our usual writer for these films. Music, once again, done by John Barry. And a theme by the legendary Tom Jones.
Yes.
Who said that when he filmed when he recorded the theme, and he does that high pitch, or that last where he holds it, Thunderball, that he went so far he passed out.
Wow.
In the recording booth. Synopsis for this film. Spectre is back in this one. They steal two nuclear warheads, because we were actually introduced to the idea of Spectre in Dr. No, and they made an appearance in From Russia with Love. They're behind the plot in that film. They return in this one. They steal two nuclear warheads, and Bond is sent in to investigate the dastardly Emilio Largo, the one-eyed number two man at Spectre, who I'll admit, I love that dude as a Bond villain. We'll get to that in later. But he also must deal with red-headed femme fatales and sharks as he sets out to
With
complete
freaking
his
laser
mission.
beams on their heads.
I'm sorry, we couldn't afford laser beams.
Well, what could you afford? Sea bass. Chilean sea bass.
Are they ill-tempered sea bass?
My God, I've got to go back and watch these movies myself.
I love that. Are they ill-tempered sea bass?
Yes.
Of course. Why just start?
Yeah, just start.
But of course he has to complete his mission before the deadline to the ransom is reached. The cold open for this one, I'll admit it's a little too short for me. I enjoy it, but it's him tracking this guy who fakes his own death and is disguised as the fucking widow for some reason beyond my understanding. And Bond only notices it's him because you shouldn't have opened that door for yourself. It gave you away. Like, women don't open doors for themselves. But he has a great fight because that the guy who's playing that character is Bob Simmons. He's the crooked man disguised as a woman, and Bond quickly takes him out. But the excitement of this opening credit, which I'm sure was exciting in 65, it was exciting when I saw it as a kid, was the jetpack that he uses in the movie. Now, this jetpack was real. The pilot was named Bill Suter. He was asked if it was an experimental, I think, military jetpack or something like that. It was,
From what I understood, they developed it. That was the goal, was they were going to sell it to the military. Once it was perfected, but it ended up you go through fuel very fast. It doesn't work very well. It's not efficient. So it became a thing. They realized, well, we could still do this at like air shows and stuff, and we can make an attraction out of it, you know, the amazing flying man type of thing.
And the producers asked Suter, will you fly it without a helmet? To which he looked at them and went, fuck no. It's a goddamn jetpack. I'm literally wearing jet fuel on my back. And so because they didn't want Bond to have to wear the helmet. And I will admit, when you see those close-ups of Connery in the fucking helmet, it's pretty goofy. It's pretty goofy. But but it's over too quick because he lands, he loads it into the back of the Aston Martin DB5, and he sprays water at the villains that are coming after him from the DB5's gadgets. And then we're into the opening credits. Suter said he loved it when he saw Connery just take it off and just shove it in the trunk. He said, because there's no way he would have been able to handle that thing if he had actually landed with the real jetpack. He said the thing would have been way too fucking hot. Like I said, it's fine, but it could have been more, maybe some more action to build up to the jetpack. That's my big problem, is there's not really enough that happens before it. And you can tell that. Yeah, back in the day, that's probably what thrilled everybody, and that was enough. But we then get our villainous meeting once again. Emilio Largo is played by Adolfo Celi. I think I'm saying his name right, or Celi, maybe Celi. And he turns in a truly sinister performance. I mean, he's got the eye patch, which, let's face facts, number two. And that inspired the actual number two. And he goes to this place where there's a secret meeting with Spectre, and Blofeld is once again in this movie. And once again, we do not see his face in this one. We got to wait just one more movie. We'll see him next week in all his glory. But this one, he's faceless. And once again, the faceless Blofeld is played by Anthony Dawson, who played Professor Dent in Dr. No, and also played the faceless Blofeld in From Russia with Love. This is also another inspiration for Austin Powers, because they're all sitting in chairs, and you know, he's talking to this one henchman who says, But sir, we collected all the money. No, no, no. I'm certain one of you failed. And he hits the button of another henchman, mm-hmm. whose chair electrocutes him to death. Then Emilio Largo goes on to say, "Hey, we've got this plan. We're going to steal these warheads. We're going to hold the world ransom." Okay. Yeah. Everyone okay with that? most prominently, this meeting is spoofed in Austin Powers, if y'all haven't guessed that. I mean, real quick, before I continue, I've been meaning to ask you, I did it before Goldfinger. What did you think of Thunderball? Let me ask you that.
Oh, it's a good movie. I liked it. You know, this is the point where they start becoming more of the same, but not, you know?
Yeah.
By now, the whole thing has been established. This is what a Bond movie is going to be, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. I love the Tom Jones. So, yeah, I like Tom Jones singing. Which, by the way, he's Welsh.
Good thing.
And so is Shirley Bassey. Both Welsh singers. Yes. By the way, just in case you didn't know this, Shirley Bassey is still alive.
Yeah.
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 She is 87 years old, I believe. Yeah.
I gotta ask, is Tom Jones still alive?
No, I think I am not sure.
I gotta look this up.
Yeah, you go ahead on and you can go ahead on and go, and then I'll look this up real quick here while you're doing
it. Yeah, 83 years old. He's still kicking.
I'll be.
But anyway, then we team back up with Bond. Bond is on leave at a resort when we meet up with him again. He is on legitimate leave, but he recognizes a symbol on a person's hand that's there, so he can't help but to investigate.
Of course.
The assassin picks up on the fact that he's trying to investigate him, and so he makes an attempt on one of those... it looks like a torture rack, but it's meant to like stretch out the spine. Like she puts him on this thing and she puts it on a slow speed. And then of course the villain comes in and cranks it up and it starts to go super fast until before it can kill him. The nurse, his physical therapist, comes in and turns it off. And, of course Bond uses this to his advantage. Cause he says at that point, someone's going to pay for this. Now he's talking about the villain. But she goes, "Oh, you're not going to tell on me, are you?" He's like, "Well, not unless we, you know.
Yeah.
We bang." The actress playing the physical therapist, whose name is Patricia Fearing, the character name, is Molly Peters. Once again, another model who was discovered by Terrence Young. She has actually a kind of an interesting story in that her agent was kind of screwing her out of some roles and also like taking too much money. And there was a whole thing where like when she fired him, he blacklisted her for a while. So by the time she could get parts again, it was kind of too late. She's beyond her prime. It was kind of a crazy story. I don't know the full details and I may have just gotten some of that wrong, but yeah, she kind of got screwed over by an agent that kind of cost her career, her film career at least. Anyway, while Bond is at the hospital, we then go to a hotel where we meet. All right, I'm going to fuck up so many names in this series. Luciana Paluzzi, I think. Mm-hmm. But she plays Fiona. The movie's femme fatale, beautiful redhead, man. Let me tell you, beautiful woman, but she's an agent of Spectre, so I can't like her. she's a soldier or she's with a soldier, named Duval. He's a French Air Force pilot. He's suddenly recalled to duty, but when he opens the door, there he is confronted with himself. And it turns out this guy, his name is Angelo, kills him with a poison real quick. And it turns out that their plot is that this guy has been given facial surgery, has been given plastic surgery mm-hmm. to look like this guy and sound like him, like they've done stuff to his vocal cords, because he's going to go in Derval's place to co-pilot the fighter that has the two nuclear bombs on them.
Right.
And he, so when they get in the air, he attaches his oxygen supply to a separate oxygen supply. He poisons everyone on the plane. And then he lands the plane, I guess, on a very shallow runway, because there's these runway lights in the water, in the ocean. And it starts to sink to the bottom of the ocean. But you know what? He got greedy. He asked for $500,000 instead of $250,000, which is what they agreed on with the Spectre. So when Emilio Largo comes to claim the warheads, he cuts that dude's oxygen supply and kills him, tying up that loose end.
Yep.
And so here's the crazy thing about this part of the movie, the bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Lamont, who was the assistant production designer on this movie, was allowed onto an Air Force base where he took hidden camera photos of the bombs.
Jesus.
And so the military was surprised when they watched the movie and they saw very accurate looking nuclear bombs, because this was at a time when civilians had not really laid eyes on what a nuclear bomb
not
actually
at all.
Looked like.
In fact, 99.9% of civilians have not seen a nuclear bomb today.
But it's for reasons like this, though, that we actually can create pretty accurate looking ones anyway.
Yeah.
For the big screen, because he went on there with the secret camera and just
way to go, security guys. Way to go.
It was a different time. We didn't look at
things
like that. So this movie, of course, this is the first of many underwater scenes. Which sometimes polarize Bond fans because, by today's standards, I mean, it looks great. The photography underwater looks great. This is one of the first films. This is one of the first films where the photography looks pretty damn clear.
They do very well with it.
And it's because they feel the studio that did it was Ivan Tor's Underwater Studios.
Mm-hmm.
These are the same people who did Flipper. That's why they went to them, because they did Flipper before this. And the director of these sequences was Raquel Browning, and he played the Gill Man in The Creature from the Black Lagoon. He's the creature in that movie. And the cameraman was Lamar Boren, who actually invented newer cameras to use in this movie. While Jordan Klein was credited as the underwater engineer. And basically what that means is Klein helped the stunt people figure out how to perform the stunts underwater. The problem with the underwater scenes for some Bond fans, not me, is, but I can see this, I understand this criticism, is they don't do a whole heck of a lot to differentiate between the two sides of who's fighting who.
Because a wetsuit's a wetsuit, man, you know?
Exactly. Well, at one point, they do at least put Bond in a red wetsuit. So at least you can tell where the hell Bond is in the scene.
Right.
But that's kind of the criticism of these underwater scenes today. And some people find them to be kind of slow. And they are. I mean, I'm not saying they're not. But that's kind of where it splits the fandom a little bit. There's another dangerous chase after the theft, though, of the bombs, where Bond is chased by the man he encountered at the clinic. But the man, because he chose someone so duplicitous as Angelo, the double, he's killed by Fiona. So Fiona inadvertently saves Bond. She comes in with that motorcycle, fires the missiles, and blows up his car.
Right.
And that's another thing. You could have gotten rid of Bond. Let him kill Bond first, and then you can kill him. But no, after this, we get a very different type of embriefing. This is a unique one. When it's learned that the bombs have been stolen and Blofeld has sent his demands, all of the double O's are brought in. They're brought in on this big, round, circular table. And the Prime Minister and M, and I think just one of their military advisors, is there to brief them on what they call Operation Thunderball, as M would call it. After that, we have a little bit more of a traditional one where Bond meets M in his office and he says, look, I know you want to send me to Siberia for this because you think there's something over here, but actually, I'd like to go to Nassau. And why does he want to go to Nassau? Because
it's the fucking Bahamas. That's why. It ain't Siberia.
But it's also where Domino is. Domino is the sister of Durval. And Bond saw the real Durval's body delivered back to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no. Durval was on the plane. And M says, well, if Bond says he saw Durval and he was dead when he wasn't supposed to be, then that's enough worth investigating. And he asked Bond, so where is Domino? Nassau. why do you, I didn't say I really wanted to go there because it was the Bahamas. That's just a perk. So he goes and he meets Domino in Nassau and learns that she is Largo's mistress. Claudine Auger, I think, is the name of the actress who plays Domino. She's Emilio's mistress. They say in the movie that's like, oh, he's my uncle. And like, you know, no, you're his kept woman is what it is. And you're awaiting, and she's awaiting the return of her brother. She thinks her brother's going to come back to her. But we're also introduced to Martine Beswick. Now, Martine as Paula Kaplan. She's a fellow agent who assists Bond in Nassau. Beswick has already been in the movie. She was one of the fighting gypsy girls in From Russia with Love. Mm-hmm. They brought her back in a different role. Sadly, she doesn't get to do much in the movie before she becomes a fatal victim.
Yeah.
In the movie later on in the movie. This is, though, the first film that establishes Bond confronting the main villain in a casino, where they play baccarat. And, of course, that's a game of fucking sheer chance in reality. And yes. But Bond always does good at it, especially against the villain. And he antagonizes him. He's like, oh, you're trying to put the specter on me. And he's like, wait. What the fuck? What do you mean by specter? The specter of defeat. Once again, parodied in Austin Powers when they play blackjack.
Yep.
And they're like, 10. I'll stay. I suggest you hit, sir. I, too, like to do things dangerous.
Yeah.
He's already beaten by the top hand of the dealer.
Right.
But anyway, fuck it. We'll talk more about Austin Powers later. Not in this episode, but maybe in the next episode. It's great. I mean, I always love a casino. One of my favorite casino scenes with Bond and the villain, though, is going to be later on in Octopussy. And we'll talk more about that later. It's a great... they're not even playing Baccarat. They're playing a whole other game. I'm not going to lie. I felt more intimidated by Largo than I did Goldfinger.
Yeah.
Because Goldfinger's just kind of a psycho businessman that just wants to set off a nuke.
Know? Well, Goldfinger's kind of a cartoonish version of a villain, too. Yeah. You know, there is a sense in Goldfinger, there is a little sense of whimsy about the whole damn thing. You know?
Mm-hmm. This is another movie that plays also to the fact that a certain character is played by different actors. Mm-hmm. Bond returns to his room where there is someone waiting to kill him. And I love that scene because he goes over to a book, flips it open, and there's a tape recorder. And he rewinds it, and he plays it, and he hears the door open and the footsteps. And so he tracks the footsteps with the recorder and realizes that the killer went to the bathroom and is in the shower. But before he can do anything about that, this mysterious man has been following him in dark shades. And when he opens the door, he's like, well, if it isn't, and then Bond punches him in the gut, pulls him in, and then he goes and takes care of the guy in the shower. He turns on the hot water and knocks the guy out. And then, of course, this guy that just entered his room is none other than Felix Leiter.
Yeah.
To which Felix is like, man, you really know how to welcome someone. I'm sorry, but you were about to call me 007. And I'm like, dude, this guy could not be knocked out on the floor, and you just revealed your fucking number. But, the mysterious man is Felix Leiter, this time played by Rick Van Nutter. And unlike Linder, I actually enjoyed this guy as Felix because he seems like a goddamn field agent and not the aging detective on his last case.
Right.
Yeah. And so I really enjoy him. Maybe not as good as Jack Lord in the first movie, but he does a good job with this role, and he has a good chemistry with Connery, I felt, throughout the movie. Bond actually lets the would-be assassin go. He tells him, he says, deliver this message to Largo. The little one I let back into the sea, meaning, you know, this, I'm going to let the small fish go, you know, because I want the big fish. So when the assassin returns to Largo, he is immediately fed to Largo's pet sharks. Now, if all this seems like a parody now, this was fucking serious then, okay?
Right, right, yeah.
It's a parody today.
This is where all, the parodies come from.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I like about that scene is that, you know, if we already knew, you know, we already know Largo's the villain, but this is a dude who'll feed his own fucking people to the sharks.
Right.
The stuntman who did that scene jumped in with live sharks right on top of him, but he demanded an extra 250 pounds in hazard pay before he would do it. Yeah. So, which back then, I guess, was good money in Britain. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's the 60s.
Yeah.
After that, Q shows up, but he's in the field. He shows up in the field to equip 007 this time and is as cranky as ever. The main gadgets this time include an underwater camera that can take pictures in the dark, which was a unique thing then.
Right.
a Geiger counter watch, a mini flare gun that like is in the size of a pen, an ink pen, and a miniature rebreather, which is probably the standout gadget. It's a little breathing device he can use underwater if he loses his tank or doesn't have anything. As Q says, provides about 5 minutes worth of air. So it gives you a little bit of that. The rebreather was done so well in the film that someone from the military called Peter Lamont to ask him, how did they create a breather that could work that small? To which Lamont had to say, sorry, mate, that's the power of editing. And people who can hold their breaths for a long time. It didn't work. and he said that the military person just embarrassingly hung up the phone. Didn't even.
Yeah.
It's like, no shit. The tension once again gets built up when Spectre calls in with the specifics of their demand. M is told that if his agents don't come in, don't find the bombs in time, they'll have to pay the $100 million.
Yeah.
So Bond investigates. Million. Yeah. Bond investigates Largo's yacht, the Disco Volante, only to be ambushed by Largo's men. But he does see that there's a big, huge door under the yacht where they could have put the bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Although he does not find the bombs yet. He gets away, but unfortunately, Paula is captured. I've lost my track here. I scrolled too far down. He takes the pictures where they discover that there's an underwater thing. And despite Bond being able to infiltrate I'm losing my track here. I'm sorry.
It's all good.
I'm too excited is what it is. Yes, while he's learning about the hatches and everything underwater, Paula is captured by Fiona and Largo's men. And so Bond learns that she has disappeared, so he goes to Largo's house to save her. But unfortunately, she's taken her cyanide capsule so that she wouldn't talk, and so she's gone. But now he has to escape the estate, and he ends up in a fight with one of Largo's men, and he falls into the pool with the sharks.
Yes.
So, the way they did this was, yes, stuntmen were used for certain shots, of course. But Connery, of course, was hesitant to get into a fucking pool full of sharks. So, Ken Adam got this plexiglass that they could submerge halfway point in the pool. Sharks would be on the other side. Connery would be on the other. And the two shall never meet.
Yeah.
What Adam didn't tell Connery is that there was about a 4 foot gap where they couldn't get enough plexiglass for. So there was a fucking gap in the plexiglass. And so there's this one scene where you see Connery backing up, like, what the fuck? And this shark is coming right at him. That's because a shark immediately went through that gap and started coming right at Sean Connery. I think it was John Steers who said, I don't think I've ever seen a person come as close to running on water as Connery did getting out of that pool. And then Connery just, in the interview he has about it, Connery just goes, I don't know whose fault it was, but it certainly didn't happen again. So when you see that, there's the shots in the movie where, like, yeah, Connery's got this look of fucking utter fear, and it's real because of the shark. He returns to his hotel room where he's captured by Fiona. Bond escapes from them, and there's this thing going that they have in Nassau called the Junk Canoe, which is basically like their version of Mardi Gras. So they have a huge parade and all that stuff. So they're chasing him through that. And a pretty tense scene plays out where Fiona captures Bond at a bar and they start to dance, and he's kind of looking around because he knows there's these two other assassins. And the music's building up. There's this one guy playing the bongos, and the music just intensifies and intensifies. And finally, he sees the gun that's about to shoot him, and so he throws Fiona in front of it, and it shoots her. One of my great all-time quips. He sets her down next to this couple and goes, "You minded my friend sets here. She's just dead," and then walks away. And then after that, he eventually finds the plane, but no warheads are on board. He does find some of Duvall's personal items, and that's what he uses to help convince Domino that, hey, look, Largo had your brother killed. Help me out. Another great one-liner is Largo has a henchman named Vargas, who I love when he introduces him. He's like, Largo offers Vargas a drink, and he's like, and he gives this kind of like sorrowful look, Vargas does. He's like, ah, Vargas. He does not eat. He does not speak. Killing is his hobby. You know, like it's that villainous speech. But Vargas is about to kill Bond, who's with Domino, before Domino tips him off, and Bond kills Vargas with a harpoon gun and quips, I think he got the point. Again, another wonderful one-liner. Probably my one-liner of the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
So Domino does try to help him find the bombs and see if they're on the ship, but Largo catches her. And then afterwards, Bond poses as one of Largo's frogmen when they're all about to go and get the bombs. And then the big finale happens. Bond gets back to his people, and Domino is captured by Largo, but then they have to have a big fight. There's a big underwater fight between, like, I guess, the military, the British military, and Largo's men. And after some intense underwater battles, though, the movie ends with a fight on the Volante, where Largo is eventually killed by Domino. Like, she saves Bond, but he jams the controls, and so they got to jump off the boat. And the boat hits the shore and blows up. Now, this was a real boat that they blew up. They were using a new type of explosive to blow it up. And John Steers didn't know how much to pack the boat with. And so when it hit
Oops.
the shore, it fucking disintegrated. Like, it dis-a-fucking-peared. And John Steers looked up, and they're on a little bitty tiny islands, so they don't have very they can't move very much in either direction, the people who are filming this. And John Steers looks up and goes, he sees a little black dot in the sky, and he says, fellas, that's the boat, and it's coming right down at us. And he said this big ball of just mangled boat landed, like, right in front of them.
Jesus Christ.
And so that's how powerful that explosion was. But another note of how explosive it was, they went back 30 miles away to where they were staying. All the windows of people's houses were blown out by that
Jesus.
explosion, 30 miles away.
Yeah, I'd say they used a bit much on that one.
They should have been hired to recreate the Trinity test.
Yeah.
But anyway, end of the day, once again, Bond gets the girl. It's the end of Thunderball. He'll be back in For Your Eyes Only.
Right.
Movie was another huge rousing success. In fact, it was such a success, it would become the highest grossing Bond film for the next 8 years until Live and Let Die was released.
Yeah.
It soon became apparent, though, after this movie, and we will discuss this in the next episode, that maybe Connery wasn't having as much fun in the role anymore. Like, right. This is the last movie where Connery, you can tell Connery enjoyed playing the role.
He
had fun with it. I think the start of the end of his fascination with the role, or his enthusiasm for it, starts at the premiere of this movie, because he drove to the premiere of Thunderball with the Aston Martin DB5, and the window was down, and a woman jumped in and tried to, just in order to touch him, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just Bond. It was like Beatlemania.
Right. And it was a bit much.
And so he was starting to have problems with how it was affecting his personal life.
Yeah.
So movie came out and was a huge hit, though. We'll get to all the Connery's other issues, because he has other issues by the time we get to the fifth movie. So I think now it's time. Jason, mm-hmm. What's your rating for Thunderball?
Sorry, folks, the Connery movies are pretty much all going to be 10 out of 10s, but 10 out of 10. jetpacks.
There you go.
Yeah, would never work in real life. Anyway,
and Jason will have to be my control a little bit in this show, because I'm the huge Bond nut. I'm obsessed with this fucking series.
Yes.
So Jason, you need to give your honest opinions, because you're going to be from a slightly less obsessed perspective.
Yeah, right.
Than I am. But I am glad you're enjoying these early Connery films, though. That's a good sign of things to come.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess now is the time for me to go ahead and rank these two films. Now, last week, Dr. No came in at number two, and From Russia With Love came in at number one. So now I got to add two more films to the list.
Right.
So at number four is Dr. No. Dr. No is still the least ranked.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is Thunderball. I put Thunderball at number three for now.
Yes.
But number two, The Rain, it just didn't last as long as it should have. From Russia mm-hmm. With Love is at number two.
Of course.
And number one for A Bullet, and I would suspect number one for at least a while, is Goldfinger.
Goldfinger.
So,
yeah, of course.
That's the Bond rankings as they stand.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I do like to end this with a recommendation of that I call Beyond Bond, which is a film that it's either related to Bond in some way, or the genre, or a similar actor, or anything of that nature.
Right.
For this week's Bond Beyond, I am choosing The Rock from 1996.
Yes.
It's one of two Michael Bay films that I love. And it stars Nicolas Cage as a chemical weapons expert named Stanley Goodspeed, who must figure out a way to save hostages from ex-military soldiers on Alcatraz. However, he is not an experienced field agent, and also needs help covertly infiltrating the prison from someone who escaped Alcatraz one time before. In comes Sean Connery, an ex-British agent named John Mason, who has been locked up for over three decades due to secrets he knows about the U.S., The movie is an action-packed thrill ride from the 90s, and both Connery and Cage have an undeniable chemistry. It's an unlikely pairing, but they work extremely well together in this mm-hmm. movie. And, of course, Jason, I also chose it because fans love to have a theory about this movie.
Absolutely.
Which is that John Mason is actually the original James Bond that has been in prison for 30 years. Helped by the line where Stanley Goodspeed says to him, "How can you do it?"
Yeah.
And Mason goes, "Easy. I was trained by the best British Secret Service."
Yeah.
So yeah, The Rock. If you've never seen it, watch it. If you have seen it, watch it again. It's always worth a revisit, and easily my favorite Michael Bay film, because after this one, he kind of starts to fall off the face of the earth and go nuts.
Yeah.
But that's it for me. Jason, do you have anything else to add? Or
not this week. I was going to do a little thing about, Fort Knox, because just to tell folks a little bit about, you know, Goldfinger and almost said Goldmember, and what was going on there. But yeah, pretty much Fort Knox is it's 109,000 acres. It's in adjacent to the Fort Knox military base, which is the home of the 5th Corps. For the longest time, and this is one of the reasons why Fort Knox was at Fort Knox, it was home to the Army's armored school. So if you did attempt to get into Fort Knox and you made it past all the security, the Fort Knox police, which there's an actual police force dedicated solely to Fort Knox, Gold Bullion Reserve. If you made it past all that, got out, now you have to make it out of the middle of a 109,000 acre complex where they will, and this is known at that time, activate the tanks and tell them, just go blow them the fuck up. And so, yeah. Goldfinger, nice try. Real life, not going to happen. Nah. But yeah. Yeah.
And that's another thing that Jason will try to add each week. Some either fact or little fact or something that
right.
connected. Like last week, yeah. You talked, I think, about the song,
Millennium by Robbie Williams that was filmed at the studios and all. Yeah.
But for now, that's all. This is the end of episode 2. Do you expect me to talk? But the Bond Bros will return in episode 3. This didn't happen to the other fellow.
Yeah.
Until then, y'all have a good day and have a great week.
All right, everybody. Bye.